You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 1st, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, as the drums of war begin anew, Trita Parsi on Bibi's Iran attack gambit. And spoiler alert, turn down your radio, your listening device, if you don't want to hear that John Kelly thinks he's working for a dangerous moron. New documents show the Koch brothers had hiring and firing power at George Mason University. North Carolina teachers call for a one-day strike in mid-May. Newly confirmed Secretary of State Pompeo in the Middle East organizing ducks in a row for a potential Iran strike. Meanwhile, Trump decides to hold off on a trade war with our allies. And billionaire Carl Icahn finally gets a financial hardship waiver from the EPA. Meanwhile, down at the border, America besieged by the first eight of nearly 150 asylum seekers from Central America. Please lock your doors. Arm yourselves. Trump legal team, most likely the leak of their own notes on what Trump might be asked if he were to sit down with Robert Mueller.
Exactly.
And the U.S. and U.K. send scientists to the Antarctic to survey the crap storm that is ultimately headed our way. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, we have a lot of stuff to get to today. Brief interview with Trita Parsi on the on what's going on with our foreign policy in regards to Iran. We are, 2 weeks away from when Donald Trump is obligated to essentially renew the Iran deal every 60 days, is it? Is it 60 or 90 days?
I believe it's 90 days.
He, as president, is required to sign off, basically re-up on the Iranian nuclear deal in terms of America's participation. I mean, keep in mind, this is not a unilateral deal between the United States and Iran. It is with most of the industrialized world. And we can drop out of this agreement does not necessarily mean that there will be sanctions or this set of sanctions, I should say, that are associated with the nuke deal will actually hold because many other countries around the world will may or may not decide to join the United States. And so in the, I guess, the what is the opposite of the wake? Anybody? In anticipation.
Anticipation.
Incoming tide.
The wave.
Thank you. In advance of this, the statutory requirement of Trump, we're seeing a lot of action. This obviously was a topic with Macron, and Pompeo is over there telling the Saudis to maybe lay off of Yemen a little bit. We will get to that with Trita Parsi. We will get into all of this. Before we do, we have a couple of clips. Well, I first want to play this one, because it's sort of funny. And the president is really building bridges. It's really impressive. This is Donald Trump, who welcomed the first leader from sub-Saharan Africa to the White House on Monday. Just a reminder, he's been in office for over a year. I mean, over...
Hold your wallets.
Yeah, exactly. Like, over 25% of his presidency, knock on wood, has passed, and he decides to bring in the first sub-Saharan African leader
Welcome,
to the country.
Prince Akeem.
Yes. And, and of course, the Nigerian president, a guy named Muhammadu Buhari, was asked about Donald Trump's earlier references to countries like Nigeria specifically. And here is Donald Trump.
Has really shown that I've been 100% right.
And President Buhari, I want to ask you, you're the first leader from sub-Saharan Africa to visit President Trump here at the White House. Did you address his reported comments from earlier this year when he reportedly used vulgar language to describe African nations?
Well, I'm very careful with what the press says about others and myself. I'm not sure about, you know, the validity or whether that allegation against the president was true or not. So the best thing for me is to keep quiet.
We didn't discuss it. And you do have some countries that are in very bad shape and very tough places to live in. But we didn't discuss it because the president knows me and he knows where I'm coming from. And I appreciate that. We did not discuss it. Mr. President, you can ask a question.
He got it. Would anyone else like to ask him a question?
But the funny part is Buhari is almost like doing everything he can to not double over in laughter. Wait, keep that up. Keep that up for a second. Because it's almost if he's like, oh man, I can't believe I just got away without having to answer that question. Like he can't even go forward a little bit more. Like when it turns to Trump, like just as soon as he throws to Trump, he is full on breaking out in laughter at least two times here. Just focus on him, right? Go ahead.
We didn't discuss it. And you do have some countries that are in very bad shape and very tough places to live in.
And then he goes
but
again.
We didn't discuss it because the president knows me and he knows where I'm coming from. And appreciate that. We did not discuss it.
That too.
Mr. President,
he says
you can
the president
ask a question.
Knows me.
I love where he's just like, I just did a very elegant job of evading that question. And now the big buffoon is going to confirm that he said it himself.
Yes.
It is like judo.
He doesn't even say, like Trump can't even say, like, look, that was a unconfirmed report. I mean, give me a break. I have a lot of respect for...
very impressive to watch the Paralympics, but it gets difficult at a certain point, if you know what I mean.
Oh, my God. Folks, you've heard me say this before. I hope now you pay attention when you go into an apartment and you see their windows. So, ladies, when you go into Matt's apartment, does he still have a sheet up? Does he have a sheet and some nails? Is that how you're doing it? Is that how you roll it? Yes.
Thumbtacks.
Yeah. Not impressive. Matt, I understand windows treatments is one of those soulless adulting terms that you millennials don't appreciate. You don't even think about your blinds unless you move or they break or someone calls you out on a podcast for having sheets on your windows.
If you want to wash up, there's some Gatorade.
But look, when your window treatments are right, everything in your house looks better. When they're wrong, everything looks bad. Now, to be honest, taking the time out to pick out blinds sounds expensive, sounds a little boring. For some folks, I'm not going to say who, installing them yourself sounds harder than any self-respecting Michael wants to admit.
Yeah, dude.
But Blinds.com makes it super easy for you. You don't know what you want? You don't know where to start? With Blinds.com, you get a free online design consultation. Just send them pics of your house. You can do it through your PSP, I think, maybe your PS4 or whatever. And they send back custom recommendations from a professional. They'll tell you what will work with your color scheme, your furniture, specific rooms. They'll even send you free samples to make sure everything looks as good in person as it does online. And every order gets free shipping. And here's the best part. If you accidentally mismeasure, it happens, folks. Supposed to measure twice, cut once. Or pick the wrong color. If you screw up, Blinds.com will make your blinds again. They'll remake them for free. They made it really easy for you. There's no excuse to leave those mangled blinds up or the sheets. For a limited time, you get up to 20% off of everything at Blinds.com when you use the promo code MAJORITY. That's Blinds.com, promo code MAJORITY for up to 20% off everything. Faux-wood blinds, cellular shades, roller shades, more, all of them, all of the window treatments. I don't know if they have that thing like where you put like that. Like, you know, the smoky tape on there. But just about every legit window treatment. You know what I'm talking about. Like, you put
what?
Like, no. All right. Blinds.com.
This is so far outside of my reality. I'm sorry.
Blinds.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Rules and restrictions apply. All right, folks. In the lead up, I spoke to Trader Parsi about, I don't know, about an hour ago. And we're going to have him back on relatively soon, timing it more or less with what Trump ultimately decides to do, because I still think that people don't have a full appreciation of what the deal with Iran does and what the terms were entering into it in terms of what the United States was trying to achieve and why it was so important. And with all that said, here is Secretary of Defense Mattis, who is talking about the deal, and he is testifying in front of a Senate, I believe, I don't know if it's the Defense Committee. This was, I don't know, 4 or 5 days ago. And he talks about reading the deal and that it's provisions for keeping Iran honest are extensive.
Right. Well, we all recognize the JCPOA was an imperfect arms control agreement.
And was not supported by the Congress.
Yes, sir. I understand, Senator. And I think that their use of denial and deception to hide their nuclear weapons program, not their nuclear plan, their nuclear weapons program over many years, have them in a position of being suspect. I've read it now 3 times, all 156 pages or whatever it is, including since I got into this job, I was able to read the short classified protocol. And I will say that it is written almost with an assumption that Iran would try to cheat. So the verification, what is in there, is actually pretty robust as far as our intrusive ability to get in, IAEA to get in, that sort of thing.
So, all right, he's talking about the JCPA is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Like I say, signed by all 5 members of the permanent members of the UN Security Council. And I think all the members of the European Union, and you have our Secretary of Defense, maybe on the way out, who knows, but saying, look, and I think he plays up, like there was definitely reason to not trust Iran in this instance. And the document is built in such a way that it enters into this agreement without the naivete.
And let me just say real quick, I mean, Mattis is a very anti-Iran guy going back to Iraq. So I don't think it's all just even his sense of strategy. He personally loathes the place, but, you know, facts are facts in this case.
I'll add, while we're doing this, I also think that Mattis realizes, like, we don't have any other option. Like, here is the guy who is quite aware of the limitations of the U.S. military. And I think he realizes, like, we don't have an option here. A U.S. invasion or attempt to destroy or destabilize Iran, there's just no military solution to this. So that's where we are on the U.S. side. Now, however, in addition to Saudi Arabia, Israel has a huge, I guess, investment, one could say, in the United States scrapping this deal and then going to the next step, which is ostensibly to bomb Iran. Saudi Arabia, of course, the other major player in the region that has a similar investment. And so what do you do if you are the leader of, or the prime minister, I should say, of Israel? You know Donald Trump is either made this decision and needs help selling the decision to scrap the deal, or you have a audience of one and you want to try and convince him to scrap the deal. What do? Well, you give a little a TED talk with complete with slides and props, and Bibi Netanyahu delivers. He has just basically said the Iranians have said for years that they don't have a nuclear weapons program. However,
Iran lied. Big time. After signing the nuclear deal in 2015, Iran intensified its efforts to hide its secret nuclear file. In 2017, Iran moved its nuclear weapons files to a highly secret location in Tehran. A few weeks ago...
Pause it for one second. I just want you to say and know that there's no one in this office, maybe it would take a couple hours, who couldn't come up with the exact same slides headlines above there. This is... So all I would say at this point as watching the presentation, not that dramatic. We need a little more drama, BB.
A few weeks ago, in a great intelligence achievement, Israel obtained half a ton of the material inside these vaults. And here's what we got. 55,000 pages. Another 55,000 files on 183 CDs. Everything you're about to see is an exact copy of the original Iranian material. First, Iran lied about never having a nuclear weapons program. 100,000 secret files prove the error. Second, even after the nuclear, Iran continues to preserve and expand its nuclear weapons know-how for future use.
There we go. Wait, we're going to have to take
a break.
They
actually dismantled it pursuant on the deal?
His argument, and even in the context of this presentation, he doesn't make any claim that anything is ongoing. It's just that they found these documents.
It's all historical.
So that is the backdrop of why we brought on Trita Parsi today to discuss that a presentation. And let's just say that presentation, it seems to me, has been widely criticized, like across the board, as far as I can tell at this point. I mean, we need a little more time, but if this was indeed used as some type of mechanism to sell the U.S. to drop out of the Iran deal, I don't think it did very well.
It was definitely aimed at Trump, though, with the big time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and with the music.
The music, we should say.
It was a bit much.
Yeah. I mean, I should say, just in all transparency, we added the music because the original music they had was just not as bouncy.
As Zarif says, the Iranian foreign minister, he's like, it's a deal that nobody's happy with, and that's why it worked.
We got to take a quick break. When we come back, Trita Parsi. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Trita Parsi. He is the author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Welcome back to the program, Trita.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
So yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, Benjamin Netanyahu provided a remedial TED Talk on the Iranian nuclear program, as he called it. Give us a sense of what he actually presented.
He actually presented nothing new. He essentially focused his presentation on activities Iran had engaged in between 1999 and 2003, which had some military dimensions. And the world already knew this. This was nothing new whatsoever. In fact, there are reasons to believe that the Israelis actually did not hack Iran. They hacked the IAEA and got this information from the IAEA rather than the Iranians. Because in July 2015, as part of the nuclear deal, as a side agreement, the Iranians agreed to cooperate with the IAEA investigation and hand over all the information that was requested, as well as make all of the individuals involved in these activities available to the IAEA to interview. The IAEA then completed that report by December 2, 2015, and concluded that they were now content and that the matter could be closed. And the Board of Governors of the IAEA, 35 countries, voted unanimously to close this file. If Netanyahu wanted to open that file again, he needed to produce something new, present something that changed his picture. He did not do that. He only reinforced what people already knew. If he had made a claim, which he didn't, he insinuated and he wanted to leave the people with the impression that Iran had continued these activities after 2009 or after 2015, but he presented no evidence of that. If he had that evidence, he should have presented it. If he doesn't, then he has not changed anything.
And so, I mean, who was the audience for that presentation, if we call it? I mean, because I get the sense there's about one person who he was really trying to reach with that thing.
Well, I'm actually not even sure about that, because I don't think this was done in order to convince Trump of anything. Trump already is convinced that he wants to kill the deal. This may actually have been done in coordination with the Trump administration to make a public case that will make the decision to kill the deal less politically costly. That may have been their calculation, because then they can say, or they thought they could say, that they are now killing the nuclear deal, not because Iran has violated anything that the IAEA has caught, but because the Israelis have revealed information that clearly puts Iran in a negative light, and as a result, that's the justification for pulling out of the nuclear deal.
So who is
that? That may be the case that they're building up. I think they completely failed. If you see the media reporting on this, it's quite clear. There's nothing new in there, so it's not really anything that he managed to impact.
So who are they trying, though, to convince? Would that have been the American public? Because it seems to me the European allies, I mean, at the highest levels, the intelligence agencies of the European allies who are involved, who are also part of this Iran deal, people should remember this is not a unilateral deal between the United States and Israel. This is a multi-party deal. They must surely, if if we can look at this and see that there's holes, that he's not even making an assertion that this is ongoing, that he's simply repeating what was a national intelligence estimate, I think from 2007, that the CIA said, yeah, they had a program that they had come up with some plans. They stopped in 2003. If he can't present anything to convince lay people, they can't be thinking that they're actually going to convince European partners, do they?
I don't think they think they can convince the European partners, but if you have lazy reporting in the United States, a presentation like this combined with what appears to have been a deliberate misspelling in the White House's press release yesterday, in which they said that the United States is convinced that Iran has a robust clandestine weapons program, not had, but has, then you are starting to create that type of a misconception that led 79% of the American people to believe that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11, and as a result, the invasion of Iraq was justified. It seems to be part and parcel of that process, just a little bit more clumsy and a little bit more skepticism from the public, because we've already been through a charade like this before.
Okay, so just give us a sense of what, I mean, what would be the end game from the Israeli perspective, and frankly, from the perspective of someone like John Bolton. I mean, what would be the end game? Once you scrap this deal with Iran, what next?
Once you scrap this deal with Iran, you will either have massive sanctions reimposed on Iran, or it will go as far as a military confrontation. In both of those scenarios, the balance of power, they believe, will shift in Israel and Saudi Arabia's direction. Right now, as a result of the Iraq invasion, the Iranians have managed to rise in the region, expand their influence, and this has primarily come at the cost of the U.S.'s influence, Israel and Saudi Arabia's influence in the region. And the Israelis and the Saudis have been pushing this on the U.S. for the last 10 years. They wanted a military confrontation to be able to go back to the pre-2003 balance of power that existed when Iran was isolated and contained in the region. If you kill the nuclear deal, you can snap back these sanctions, once again cripple the Iranian economy and shift the balance in the favor of Israel and Saudi Arabia, or you can go even further by having a military confrontation, which the Israelis certainly believe, if the U.S. conducts, will lead to a scenario in which Iran will be significantly weakened. This is not about nuclear weapons. This is not about the nuclear program. It's even not really about regime change. It's about the balance of power in the region. And the Israelis and the Saudis know that they cannot shift it in their favor on their own. They can only do so if they can rent the American military.
And I mean, forgive me if this sounds naive, but what does that mean from a like a tangible perspective? If there was a shift in the balance of power, what does that mean on a daily or even like a yearly basis? What is the tangible impact or results of a change in a balance of power?
Well, you have to remember that right now the Middle East is in flux. We don't have a stable situation. We don't have an equilibrium in the region. And as a result, what we're seeing right now, if the trajectory continues, which is what the Israelis and the Saudis fear, you will likely see the Iranians become more influential, as will the Russians and others. So just take a look at what's happening in Syria right now. It is the Iranians and the Russians primarily that are calling the shots. This is a very worrisome perspective, you know, scenario from the Israeli perspective and certainly from the Saudi perspective. We are not in a region that actually has an established order in which the rules of the game are there and whatever shifts in power occur are limited because the order is not going to be challenged by any specific party. We are in an orderless Middle East, and the struggle right now is to establish that new equilibrium, and all great powers will seek to do so in a way that is obviously beneficial to them. This is what makes the Middle East very similar to all other regions. This is exactly what happened in Europe before as well. The difference is that the Israelis and the Saudis know that they cannot do this on their own. They don't have the power to be able to change the current equilibrium in their favor. They can only do so if they can suck the United States into this conflict.
And is there, I mean, so the Israelis genuinely believe that there can be some type of ground war in Iran and that the United States can come out of it victorious? I mean, what they seem to
be. I've not heard them say anything about ground war. It would mainly be a combination of first weakening the country significantly through sanctions, supporting ethnic separatist groups in the border areas that would then further weaken the Iranian state, and then you add military strikes through mainly air, very limited ground invasion, I would imagine. And that would be enough to essentially cause the crumbling of Iran. And then you will have perhaps a similar situation as you're seeing in Syria today. You didn't have to invade the country militarily, but enough has been done to make sure that that country is essentially a collapsed state and that has no capacity to really pose a challenge to Israel or to whichever country would be seeing some benefit from it.
Okay.
You know, during the Iraq-Iran war, it was a very interesting statement that came out of Tariq Aziz, who was Saddam Hussein's foreign minister. And he put it very clearly. He said, it is much easier to be the neighbors of six small Irans than one big Iran, indicating that their preference was to do something that would cause the Iranian state to collapse, this internal civil war leading to six different states rather than one united Iran.
Right. So the idea would be to destabilize the country and just lessen its ability to deliver a sort of cohesive, foreign policy from their perspective, or a cohesive ability to strike anywhere, or just injure it in some fashion. And what is the danger of something like that? I mean, why, you know, aside from obviously the moral implications of crippling a state and creating a failed state, I suppose we're seeing what the potential dangers are when you look at what came out of Afghanistan in 2001, right? And what are the other dangers in creating a failed state?
Once you have a failed state, first of all, the destabilization is likely not going to be contained to the Middle East itself. It is likely going to spill over to other regions, whether through terrorist groups being able to find a foothold, whether it is drug cartels, or whether it is simply is a massive flow of refugees. I mean, take a look at Syria. We're talking about a country of 25 million people. Iran is 80 million people. And Iranians actually have a strong diaspora as a result of the revolution. Roughly 2 or so million Iranians live in the West. So you have a lot of family connections. So you can imagine a destabilization of Iran leading to massive, massive refugee flows. And we have already seen how Europe is incapable of handling Syrians coming into to Europe. You can imagine how much tougher it would be if a country three times the size of Syria were to be destabilized. So this, beyond the moral implications, as you mentioned, of, you know, the complete immorality of destabilizing a country, the belief that this will be contained is utterly naive. This will spread and it will make everyone a loser.
All right. I have just two more questions that may be tangential. There are reports that Secretary of State Pompeo was pressuring the Saudis to pull back on their war within Yemen. But what do you make of that? I mean, that seems like a slight turnaround.
Sorry, I didn't quite catch the entire question.
Well, there's a report from the New York Times that Mike Pompeo was in Saudi Arabia this weekend, and he was pressuring the Saudi government to end the war in Yemen. Is this in any way related to, I mean, are we seeing, are there any ducks that are being lined up in that instance?
Yes.
I
do believe so, because Pompeo went there and he pressed Saudis to end their beef with Qatar and end the war in Yemen. And he made it quite clear, in order to be able to have a united front against Iran and making sure that all resources are put towards this confrontation with Iran that the Trump administration is preparing, you cannot be allowing yourself to be distracted with a silly fight with Qatar, or to this ongoing war in Yemen that is not only destroying that country, but is also bleeding the Saudis in a way that is unhelpful if you want everyone to focus on Iran.
So that is an indication, at the very least, that there is an attempt to, there's a bit of a wind-up here, I guess.
I certainly believe so. I mean, when you take a look at everything that is happening, and particularly when you take into consideration that the people that are now around Trump are individuals who have been arguing to go down this path for years. Bolton in particular has been very open about his ideas of pursuing war and destabilization in Iran. And now he's at the NSC and has the ability to turn those ideas into policy.
All right. Well, Trita Parsi, thank you so much for your time today. I know you're a busy man today. We would like to have you back, and we can maybe do a more comprehensive
Anytime.
Talk about the treaty, which very well this Iran deal may, the next time we have you back on, may be just in the midst of perhaps falling apart, unfortunately. But we will talk to you again. Thank you so much, Trita Parsi.
All right. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
All right, folks, and before we go into the fun half, we've got to deal with this. As you know, today is May 1st. What's that? Exactly. May Day. But that's actually secondary to what is really special about this day. It is the day before Wednesday. And in fact, let's do this. We are now 23 hours, 20 minutes, and 49, 48, 47, 46, 45, 44, you get the idea, seconds away from Dennis Miller's few brutally mean jokes about Michelle Wolf.
I have to say, if I'm Michelle Wolf right now, I'm feeling a lot of heat. I might be considering for the first time Wikipediaing who Dennis Miller is, as an example. You know, we're getting close here. And I think the 80s references we should be readying ourselves for are going to be essential.
Yeah, I think clearly Michelle Wolf right now. Maybe we could just turn down the second ticking a little
In
bit.
In fact,
just
we should keep
bit.
It should, for the whole show.
A little bit. Michelle Wolf is probably pretty worried. I would imagine they're adding servers to Twitter right now as we speak, because we don't know. And this is one of the things that I think has not gotten the attention that it really deserves. We don't know in what form these jokes will take. They could be on Twitter. For all I know, Dennis Miller still could be on MySpace. He could be publishing them on MySpace or CompuServe.
It could be on Stormfront.
They could be on Stormfront. We don't know. And we don't really have any idea, while we're at it, what Dennis Miller could be reading about Michelle Wolf. Because I want to remind people, let's just go back to the original tweet that we're discussing here, because this is important that we get this right, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, that's a methodology to Miller, a very kind of scholastic approach.
Let me just read off the tweet, and if we could bring it up on the big board, I don't know if we can do that. But Dennis Miller, DMZ, this is from 3:16 a.m. Eastern Time. He is, of course, we think, on the West Coast. Of course, Dennis Miller is, in many respects, bi-coastal. I imagine he travels quite a bit from his home, I think in Malibu, to some other elite enclave.
Hits from Bakersfield to Teaneck.
And Dennis Miller, at Dennis DMZ, what a horrid human being Michelle Wolf is. I'm going to read up on her over the next couple of days. And I will have a few brutally mean jokes about her by Wednesday. Now, we have yet to see any of those brutal mean jokes, or even not mean jokes. And now, some people have suggested, hey, I think Dennis Miller was just joking himself. But that would be weird to say Wednesday because that's not funny.
To be fair, we are talking about Dennis Miller with regards to not funny. But yes, there is speculation that I'm going to read up on her. Joke's coming Wednesday. Bop, bop, bop. Fill in your own bop, bop, bop. That was, in fact, the joke. But I think we could still expect some 80s references and some, I was thinking, potentially a Carrot Top hair joke, although I think that might be far too current
for
Miller.
I've got a couple of possible ones that we've had our analysts working on that we might, we'll break out in a moment. But I think we really need to focus on this point, and maybe we should have had some type of debate on this topic.
Yeah.
But why would you, if you were telling a joke, if you were trying to be funny about this and not being serious, why would you say Wednesday as opposed to Tuesday? Is it because Wednesday starts with a W and that's more funny? And because my understanding is, and I believe I've seen Roseanne Barr tweet this out, that like the 14th joke rule of comedy is the hard consonants. Now, this is, you know, people have always said that like the K's, the K, as opposed to a W, W, not as funny. So why not? I'll have a few brutally mean jokes about her by Tuesday, which I think is funnier than Wednesday.
Well, that would be fun, although he's leaving himself a little bit more of a window in case he does want to actually do those jokes. But I mean, as anybody who's ever observed Miller, whether it's watching him his NFL gig or most stand-up appearances or most convos with Bill O'Reilly, he's definitely willing to go to the beat of his own drummer, as it were.
Interesting. Now, there's also been a theory that's been floated that maybe he's talking about next Wednesday. How do you know it's this Wednesday? Mm. However, he does say, and can we bring that back up on the big board, the tweet, just so that we can focus in on this? He does say, if you recall, there it is. Okay, you'll notice he says, I'm going to read up on her over the next couple of days. Couple, of course, is sometimes in the vernacular, people will use it instead of a few. But I think in this instance, now maybe he's using couple because it's got that k-k sound.
Right.
And if you said, I'm going to read up over her over the next few of days or few days, that's not as funny as couple of days.
He's a very cerebral comedian. He sneaks in the where you least expect it. If he's reading up on Michelle Wolf, though, I'm curious, other than the controversy that we already know about, that everybody knows about, what else is he going to find? I mean, Netflix special?
Well, there is. Is he aware of what apparently Netflix is? Stormfront did put out a fake paper saying that she was convicted of bestiality. But we do have a couple of jokes here that we think
it was bestiality in the 1990s.
We could see, you know, and maybe it involves him reading up on her. I mean, who knows? Yeah. He didn't. And I want to make this point clear with 23 hours and 14 minutes and 46 seconds to go that he did not say he was necessarily going to use the stuff he read about her in the jokes. This is what is known as a misdirect.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Sometimes used in magic as well as in comedy. So you could get a joke like the White House correspondence dinner got a real firecracker of a host in Michelle Wolf. The correspondents thought they were getting Balto, but really ended up with Cujo.
Bop, bop, bop.
Because we don't, no, not, no. Not when I do it. Yeah. Because her last name is Wolf.
Right.
And now Cujo, very famous wolf that you would not want to meet. Balto is technically not a wolf, but I think that, you know,
I think as they say in the bop, bop, bop stands.
Right. Now,
Balto.
This is another, you had mentioned this too, because of her reddish tint to her hair.
Right.
We could see something like this. Michelle Wolf was so over the top, she made her twin brother Carrot Top look as placid as Stephen Hawking.
Now, think that this is strong. I think the second one in particular, we're really dangerously close to current references.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Carrot Top is a bit more of, my understanding, a late 90s kind of thing.
Still alive.
Which is, and also still alive. Stephen Hawking, of course, going back to the 70s. Right. but passed away recently. And I think when you're kind of talking that time frame, you're getting dangerously out of step with Miller's.
I think this one is going to address that because, as you know, Michelle Wolf mentioned that Sarah Huckabee Sanders had a good, what was it called, eye dusting?
Smoke, that would be a smoky eye.
Smoky eye, mm-hmm. Which apparently I have been told is actually a hard thing to achieve.
Yes, that is true.
Because you have to like gradate the makeup. So he may go after her for some of the cosmetics that she used. So we thought maybe it might end up being something like this. I don't want to say Michelle Wolf's lipstick looked bad, but let's just say it looks like Daniel Day-Lewis won't be getting another Oscar for My Left Foot 2. So
I'm going to speculate that that is so close that if Miller has enough energy, he might accuse us of hacking his
Well, we could have done the same thing that the Israelis did right. With the Iranian documents that we actually got them from, you know.
We found documents from 1990 and we realized that he was planning on telling these same jokes again, just substituting Michelle Wolf's.
We're going to do, no, we've got a lot more investigating to do. One of the things that we've got people working on right now is to determine whether or not there are actually people faxing jokes to, and I do mean faxing jokes
there would definitely be
to
faxed.
Dennis Miller. Yes, that's correct. Still. He only takes the jokes by fax. And we're just not sure. So we are now at 23 hours, 11 minutes, 30 seconds.
One other question I just would like to put into the mix. If this, if these jokes are brutally delivered in the form of a Breitbart column, will there be a second editor's note reassuring readers that Andrew Breitbart found Dennis Miller incredibly funny? I think that's also something we need to look out for.
Yeah, this is something we're continuing our coverage. We may extend the show tonight after 11 p.m. Tune in. We may have a live coverage because at 11 p.m. it's 8 p.m. on the West Coast. And it's quite possible. Look, Dennis Miller does not have to deliver this tomorrow at noon. He could deliver it by Wednesday. And so we will keep you updated. In the meantime, we're going to take a break and head into the fun half. Before we do, Jamie, my understanding is that you have also a something that you want to talk about.
Yes. Yes, I do. I've been working pretty hard on this healthcare event that I helped put together for the DSA, and it's happening on May 12th. Just want to plug it a little bit at Brooklyn Bazaar in Greenpoint. It's sort of a community healthcare fair that comes at the issue from all different angles. We're going to have some useful workshops on signing up for Medicaid, cooking on a budget, consent, Narcan training, and a panel. As well, panel discussion featuring Tim Faust, Emma Katterine from our Socialist Feminist Working Group, which is working really hard on the big push for Medicare for All nationally as well as in the state of New York, and State Senate candidate Julia Salazar, who's a DSA member who we just voted to endorse. And the panel will also be moderated by someone, but I can't remember who.
Well,
it's our very own Michael Brooks.
There you go. Hey, well, hold on for a second.
So yeah, come on down.
It's going to be very fun, guys. It's awesome how many practical activities there'll be before the conversation.
Okay, so you will also like things like help with signing up for Medicaid and Medicare, or no? Just Medicaid.
I need to double check on that, but yeah, we're going to have someone showing people how to sign up for the benefits.
All right, we will put a link to that if you have any questions at majority.fm.
Tonight, TMBS, Waz and Brejoy, 7 p.m.
Waz and Brejoy on TMBS tonight. Don't forget, you can go to patreon.com/antifada for...
The Antifada.
The Antifada. Sorry.
That's okay. It's very new. We have a new episode up right now, actually, with Ross Wolf of the Charnel House, and we talk a lot about left communism and all kinds of crap. It's great.
Also, folks, don't forget, this program exists because of its members. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your membership that keeps this show alive. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you some bonus material. So check it out, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, iTunes reviews also help. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you're on Steam It, steam our videos. Is that what you call it, Brendan? You steam them? Steamicize them. Yeah. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.